Joining me in studio, David Abramson, psychologist in a private practice. David, a very good morning.
Good morning, Howard. Good morning, Zanatti.
Morning.
What is, why are you still laughing?
No, nothing. It's a private conversation, Howard.
Oh, right, because that's what we do in studio. We do that. So, David, what do you think? It's beautiful outside, isn't it? You're the most recent outside person we've had.
It's feeling warmish. I'm loving it.
No, these are lies.
He's a psychologist. He knows this. I think maybe we need to spend just a moment to understand why Zanatti is so resistant to the feeling of warmth. Why she's holding on to the cold, to the iciness.
You have a chapter about this in your book.
Oh God. All right, fine. If you want to go and buy the book, go and buy the book. It's there at Exclusive or Take a Lot. Smile, damn it, yeah.
Might be chapter 5.
Might be. Actually, I would have no idea what chapter it is. But it is beautiful outside. It is. It's gorgeous.
It's not that biting cold, Zanatti.
Wow.
Yes. It's not when you go running for your coffee in the morning. You have it because you like the taste, not because you need to warm up.
Exactly. And the next cold front is like in May next year.
Yeah.
Zanatti.
Wow, guys. No. I have blankets and jackets on.
Howard, am I thinking too deeply when we think maybe it's got to do with the relationship breakup?
No, they're back together.
What? Where have I been?
It's summer in my heart, David. Very warm in my heart.
Oh, okay. Sorry. There goes that theory.
You guys, I can't. No, it's not summer. It's heading to spring. We are going there.
All right. Well, you know what? There's nothing I can say, David.
I'm tired of the United Front now.
You know, I was just going to say, you were doing so well. You really, really were doing very, very well, and you were supporting me on this.
No, not anymore.
I have to say, if you've ever been to Umhlanga, there is no winter.
Really?
Yes.
Oh.
It's like summer all around.
I find that very irritating. I find that very, very irritating. You know what? God gave us seasons for a reason. You know what? We've got to celebrate each season as they come. This whole blandness of not having a season is very, very Umhlanga.
Do I sense a bit of jealousy?
No, I actually don't like Umhlanga.
Really?
I don't.
Wow.
There we go. I'm going to come out and say it. I'm not an Umhlanga person.
So do we have to do this in alphabetical order? Brakpan, Benoni, Umhlanga.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Springs. Once you're in that area, Brakpan, Benoni, Springs, with a hint of Edenvale. David Abramson, psychologist in a private practice, joining us in studio today, and we are talking about teen mental health. David, is it my imagination, or do we have an increasing problem with teen anxiety, depression, and mental health in general?
Morning, Howard. Yeah, I'm so glad that we're talking about this because I know we did speak about this, you know, kind of a couple of weeks ago. But I think, of course, teenage years forever has been a very difficult time developmentally. I mean, when you think about it from a physical point of view, you think about it from an emotional point of view, a social point of view,
right,
a neurological point of view. There is so much change happening. So I think it's always been a difficult time, a time of huge transition. But absolutely, you know, we've seen over the last decade that the increase in mental health difficulties in children and teenagers has increased dramatically. And we're struggling to try and understand why this is. But you know, there was a huge study done. 8 million people were involved in this study that showed that, you know, if you were born in 1999, you were roughly 50% more likely to experience a mental health difficulty than if you were born in 1985. And they were trying to understand.
That's a dramatic increase in a short period.
It's a huge increase in a short period. Yeah. And, you know, the researchers, you know, which was done in America, were trying to understand why this is. And they reluctantly, even in the, almost apologetically, you know, came to the conclusion that it was around this time that this group of people, they called them the iGen, actually, because of the being attached to the iPad, the iPhone,
the iPad, right.
They maybe, and it sounds like a cliche, after looking at all the factors, actually said, but what is the one thing, which is the biggest factor, you know, that has changed over the years? And they reluctantly, actually, almost apologetically, as I say it's around screens, around social media. But I think we need to unpack that.
Because I just think that my concern with that is we're just throwing it. Mm. Anything that goes wrong, we say, oh, it's social media.
Exactly.
Oh, it's screen time. And my problem with that is it exists and we're not going to change it. We are not going to get rid of screens and social media. But we've got to try and understand, instead of just using the term, what is it about it and how do we help our teenagers?
Absolutely. And listen, the study didn't get away without being criticized or certainly people, asked whether they could really jump to this conclusion, whether it was a bit too simplistic. But I think absolutely. I think for me, if we look at this generation of teens and young adults, if we look at what screens are not going away. YouTube is not going away. WhatsApp is not going away, or Facebook. But it's really about trying to understand how it's affected their lives in general, not just by being on screens. And I think there's a couple of things that we need to look at. And the one is, I think, just the amount of information that, teenagers and young people have these days. It's just completely overwhelming. And we might have mentioned this before. If there's anything happens, any part of the world, you hear about it. And I think it does create a degree of anxiety, of information overload, if anything negative happens, you do tend to hear about it. As I say, a plane crashes, a massacre happens.
And it's brought right to you.
And it feels so real.
There's no distance between you and the event,
no,
almost.
No, because, again, you get to see it sometimes in real time. Sometimes you see victims, you see bystanders, and it feels so real. And again, it's not unusual to have, and I've experienced this, young people experiencing huge amount of anxiety because they've seen a traumatic event happening in another country, and that concern about it happening to them, even though it is so physically removed from them. So I think the amount of information that we or that the teenagers today consume is just too much. And the same thing when we talk about the social media, I think we just know too much. We know too much about where our friends are, who they're with, what they're doing.
But they've gone out without us.
They've gone out without us.
Because there's a picture of them having fun somewhere. Why aren't I there having fun with them?
It's just, I think, too much information. And I think, absolutely, is it a reality that
why haven't they liked my photo? Mm. Why hasn't this person liked it? What is going on with
that?
Why
haven't they?
Right. Why have I only got 20 likes and not 50 likes like I had yesterday?
Why have I been blue ticked? Why have they read my message and they haven't? You can project into that silence of like why that person hasn't returned my.
Zanati's a big blue ticker.
Yeah, I am.
Zanati, we'll start I am as well. But people assume young, especially teenagers, when it comes to social interactions, it's a very social interactions, peer interactions are so important in teenagers.
And schooling, I've been in quite a few SMSs. Tanya saying, I also think the level of competition at school, the fear of no jobs when you leave school. Bev says huge pressure on the I before ready to go. We need to go to the we, not the I. But I think school is a major one. Another unsigned saying a child gets 64 for maths and parents get told that there's a problem.
I think that is such a good point, and I think that also is something that needs to be addressed.
I was talking to a nephew of mine, and he was telling me about the number in one of the subject assignments they had to do over the holidays, and it's grade 11, and they're saying, yeah, but you've got to do this because we're getting you ready for matric, and this anxiety every year that we've got to be hysterical because next year, oh boy, next year. So we're always living in fear. Our children are living in fear of next year, and then they get to matric, and then they're living fear as the listener says, of not getting a job or not getting into the university. You don't understand the competition. I think we do continue to make our children, our schools make them mad, and we make them mad.
Absolutely, and I think it's a huge...
There's no break from it.
There is no break from it. And, sometimes, if you look at the amount of work and the level of work that children are doing at such a young age, it's actually mind-boggling. And I think again it is a bit of a vicious cycle where we do get this message from, you know, the world that, you know, we've got to keep up with the South Koreans. We've got to keep up with, you know, the Harvards of this world. You know, we've got to be successful. But if we don't push our children, they're not going to survive in the world. But at the same time, you know, we have that. So where does it start? We start with the schooling system that wants to say to parents, look what a fantastic system we are. Look what we're giving to your children. Look, you're getting value for money. Look what we're doing compared to other schools. And so, again, parents do encourage often that idea of, you know, am I getting my value for money? Why aren't the children getting enough homework? What did you learn today in school? Or you played outside today instead of learning something new. Mm-hmm. Again, we're caught in this almost like vicious cycle where we actually are endorsing the pressure in many ways. And the schools, I actually feel it's sometimes very sorry for the schools as well, because they ironically, get pushed by parents often to up their game. You know, look at this other school. Why aren't we at that level? And how do we measure it? Marks. At the end of the year, marks. And
We talk about this, and we've spoken about schooling for many, many years, and everybody says, I think there's a fantastic agreement amongst most educators that the schooling system, the way we sit in classrooms, the way we're testing, the subject choices, the way we, things that we're focusing on, it's all antiquated and outdated. But are we just going to continue talking about it?
Well, that's the point. It's going to take a very,
but,
very...
But are we actually changing it? Is there one school that isn't starting off a school curriculum with kids in grade one sitting in rows of desks and being tested in an antiquated way? Is it happening?
I think it is. I think schools are trying to push back on some level. But there is this, you know, where they are not sitting in these rows, when they're not always in class, they're outside of class, where they're trying to make the curriculum more interactive. Absolutely. You know, we see this in our Jewish day schools in Johannesburg. Mm. But it is such a difficult balance to try and bring this innovative teaching in, and yet at the same time, meet the requirements of society, which is to get the best marks when you leave matric.
Right.
So it is. It's going to take a very, very brave parent body. A very brave
parent. Actually, it'll take a very brave parent to be able to say, you know what, I don't care.
Or to say, you know what, I'm okay with my child only getting 60% or actually, sorry, we need a little bit more time to finish this assignment. And I believe absolutely as parents we need to push back a bit. But really it's more about working together as a team. But it's about understanding what is a good education, what is a healthy education, and often what a good education, you know, people perceive to be a good education, is not an emotionally healthy education. So we bring up these amazing children who have covered huge curriculum, but at what cost? And I think that's the question that we need to ask. And again, the studies show that it doesn't say that the more amount of homework, the more work you do, the more successful the person is after school. It's more about what they learn and how they learn, which is vitally important.
I'd love your thoughts on it on 34519 or 061-895-1019. I'm chatting to David Abramson. We're talking about the stress, the mental stress. On Jenny says Red Hill School doesn't have exams until grade 11 and had the highest matric scores last year. Mm-hmm. So it also showing us that it's not about the exams, is it?
No, not at all. Not at all. And I think, again, often a lot of therapists I hear have, grade 11s, grade 12s talking about, you know, just feeling completely overwhelmed. I mean, when you told that when you sit down for this set of exams,
right,
it's life changing. You know, if you don't do well, then you know, your life.
Because again, I think we've spoken about it. It's teacher anxiety as well. It is school anxiety. It's teacher anxiety. And the only way, and they kind of helpless in a way. So they've got to, the kids have got to perform. So there's this pressure, this immense pressure on the children. David, are you seeing in your practice, if you look at, July 2019 versus July 2018, 17, 16 going back, are you seeing an increased amount of mental health challenges for teenagers, suicide attempts, parasuicides, etc.? Are you seeing that?
There's no question. And when I ask my colleagues, they're seeing the same things. And so, as I say, I'm so glad that we're talking about it this morning.
Is this a national crisis?
You know, they say, you know, again, statistics say 20% of teens worldwide will experience a mental health disorder. Does 20% sound like a lot to, you know, two out of 10? I don't know. But I think for me, when 20% of a population can be diagnosed, so that's very important, with a mental health disorder, I think that's a huge number.
And of course, we've also got to always balance the fact that more people are seeking help today, potentially, because there's less of a stigma.
And I think, yeah, exactly. And I think that's, you know, to talk about the solutions is really, really important, because I think we as adults, as parents, need to really help our children to take that stigma away, to help them to understand that, you know, I think that's the thing that surprises me most when I tell other, you know, young people that they're not alone, that there are so many people in their school. Obviously, we need to be ethical. We can't tell them who.
But
they're so surprised that other people are also struggling. They're so surprised that someone else
is. Even in this age, people are still very, very lonely in this. David, what are – we don't have a tremendous amount of time, and I do want to try and walk away with some kind of practical advice for parents.
Absolutely. So I think the most important thing is it's very, very difficult. You know, teenagers it's up and down. And I suppose it is very difficult to identify if your, you know, if your child is in distress or not. But I think it's so important to stay in touch with your child, and be close. Keep the communication open, even though they are so less communicative. This is a time where they want to be alone in their rooms and just interact, you know, with their friends, be on their phones, to try as much as possible.
Well, in fact, we had one of our conversations with our kids. My wife said to one of our children, you do know that you can come and talk to me about anything. And he said, no, I can't. And we thought, all right, he actually can't.
But the point is that not to take it personally, to understand that.
Oh no, I'm quite relieved. I don't want to know that. Thank you very, very much. Exactly. Keep that to yourself, pal.
But to let them know that if they don't feel that they can talk to mom and dad, that there are other people that they can talk to.
Yeah, I think the message was really about the stuff that's causing you anxiety.
Exactly.
We don't want to know every minute of every thought that you've ever had. That's really, really not our, and science says, personally, I feel for the teachers in the school, and the school parents are beyond, involving themselves in school matters and the children's social side. We are done with school, time to let your kids perform to his best ability and just be okay with that.
It's true. So I think, you know, just going back to the point of just knowing if you see a difference in your child's behavior. So again, it does take work to stay in touch with your child, to keep communicating with your child, we talk about proximity. You can't know how your child is without being closer to them. And yes, they don't want to be around us really at this age, but
yes,
family suppers are so important to check in, to talk to your child, to say that I'm around you, I'm aware of you, and I'm here for you. But also, not only what they say, it's about how they present. Are they more irritable than normal? Are they, as we've always said, watch their eating and their sleeping? Are there big changes?
Right.
Is their hygiene, you'd say all teenagers really, but boys.
Right.
But again, is it different for your child?
Right. Has there been a change? Change is a very big thing.
Linda says,
what about homework? It's such a fight.
Oh, I tell you, this is something that it's a bugbear of mine, because again, you know, when you think about it, the kids spend so much time at school. And
what are they even getting homework for?
Well, again, I think the argument is to reinforce certain work. But again, I think for me, it's
to destroy families
and to just
break down
relationships with mom and dad. I think for me, you know, it is as we've said. I think for me, going to take a very brave, brave educators who have the confidence of parents to say, trust us. Your children will get a great education. They will be successful in life, and they don't have to sit regurgitating information back to us so that we can see whether they've got a good memory. But we're going to teach them to think, and we're going to teach them to be creative, and we're going to teach them to have opinions. And clearly, it's not just words, because that's what companies are saying these days. That's the kind of people that they want. They want individuals. They want personalities.
When we speak about the fourth industrial revolution, no one's talking about Marx. We're talking about all sorts of other life skills, the need to constantly learn your communication skills, your ability to contribute to your an environment, creativity. Thinking out the box. Absolutely.
And yet, still, how many distinctions did you get? Because that's what, unfortunately, we still base things on.
Which is incredible. I got no distinctions. I don't consider myself particularly not bright. In fact, you know, I've got a very healthy self-esteem in that area. But in our time, people just didn't. You just didn't. The brightest people around us got 3 or 4 or maybe 5 distinctions. It's just how it was.
And it's so interesting now in retrospect for me to look back at the people at school. And some of the most successful people really didn't fit into the system for whatever reason. Didn't do very well in such a structured environment. Didn't do very well. Their talents weren't tapped by the system. And so the message was to them that, listen, you aren't capable. You aren't clever. And I think we focus a lot on education, but it's a huge part of the problem
of anxiety. We have to continue the conversation. We're going to be over the next while, because I do believe that there is a crisis, and I'm not somebody who's overly dramatic, but I do believe that our youth are under an immense amount of pressure, and we have a problem with that. It's 8:39. We're going to take some ads. When we come back, we're going to chat to Luba Mayakiso.